always happy to be back among friends, I hope.
It could be a bad idea.
So this is stuff that I did with Eric Bobbitt and Neil, and so I've got this, I got the long usual slides from this, but if any moment you want to ask me things, then I'll immediately go start writing. I'm not tempted to go through this on the board, but hey, I've got it all here. Good. So flavor. Well, the first rule of the first rule of paper writing is making sure that you can hike. And this is where this paper started. It can only barely be seen from here, but oh well, that's the way it goes. There's actually, you can kind of barely make out the people, but maybe the mountain is more clear from the background. When we were visiting at CERN, we started thinking about ideas related to this, and ultimately resulted in the paper. So it's one of those cases when you go up the mountain and come down again. The idea still seems good. It's like, okay, all right, we got something. So the rule of thumb is, you know, go to Aspen, go to CERN, you'll get good papers out. Flavor in supersymmetry, something that many of you are already familiar with, but I think for the non-experts, I'll do a little bit of background just to get everyone on board with where I'm going to go with this. So, the first thing is write flavor in Susie. Sorry, in flavor in the standard model, before we even get to supersymmetry. And flavor in the standard model comes from. Now I'm going to get the pointer.
There is no.
Okay, I'll lose this. So flavor in the standard model is just this, namely the Yukawa couplings of quarks coupling to the Higgs that we all know and love. And usually, when people write these things down, they suppress these famous flavoring.
Don't step on that.
Yeah, and I will try to avoid stepping on that. I could make a comment, but I'll keep going. No. Yeah. So the flavor indices that are usually suppressed, but here they are in all their great detail. Right. So these are the arbitrary matrices that one writes between the left-handed fermions and the right-handed guys when they pair up through a Higgs. Now, we all know the story of how this goes. So you mean through the VEVs. Here, V. Okay, I'm taking real, I guess. And this will result in some mass parameters for the quarks, but in general, you know, completely off-diagonal, whatever the entries are. And so the rule of thumb being that you rotate the fields to get rid of you have the freedom to rotate the fields to remove part of the Yukawa matrix structure, and you find that upon doing this rotation of the left and the right-handed fields, you end up with the famous U and D matrices, diagonal quark masses, and the only result of all of this famous rotation goes back down to weak interactions in the CM moments that we all know. Okay, so that's the standard model. Okay. Now we do SUSY, and we all know what happens there. So SUSY has its famous ensemble of parameters, soft masses, the soft mass squareds, and the scalar trilinear couplings, and all the rest of the parameters, and these have their own flavor indices as well. So I've only written a few of them for the squark and slepton mass matrices. These are, of course, 3x3. Hermitian matrices that one has between the different states of the squarks, the left-handed guys, the right-handed guys, as well as leptons and left-handed leptons, right-handed leptons, etc. The trilinear couplings, again, completely arbitrary in flavor space, not necessarily related to the Yukawas in any particular way, and their interactions. Again, go through the same exercise of rotating the superfields to remove away YUDE, and you're resulting in something that is generically not diagonal in flavor space. This is the problem. This is the whole issue of SUSY and flavor, which has been with us for all this time. Just to give you an idea of how striking this problem would be, so if you take various pieces of these elements, and then you put them into some physical process to see what is the contribution you get to a flavor-violating observable, like cana cana bar mixing, right? It goes through like this. So in the standard model, this is violated by the CKM elements in the off-diagonal, with the CK elements in the weak interactions, which couple through the W, like this, and... So this diagram is down by powers of whatever these CKM elements are, which you have the famous Jim mechanism to determine that they are in fact quite small, but with these electroweak loops. Now you go to supersymmetry and several things happen, right? So we know what happens. We can take each gauge boson and replace it with a gaugeino. The quarks can be replaced by squarks, and the relevant thing being that now we can put in a mass insertion. And moreover, not only can you replace this with just ordinary gauginos, but you can go into a colored particle. And so this diagram gets enhanced by another power of G strong divided by G weak to the fourth power. So it's bad on many levels depending on how you want to look at this. How bad? Here's how bad. Okay, so you just do this and similar types of diagrams, and you sum up their contributions, and you get something that is of order this size. Here's the size, at least with respect to when you take the squarks to be of order, the gluino mass, okay, of this neighborhood. You get a size like this. So there's our famous alpha S squared. So G to the fourth. The off-diagonal entry M12 squared divided by the squark mass squared. Okay, so we have two powers of this because of the two insertions, and then 1 over the gluino mass squared, as I've written it here. If you then go and put in the numbers, you find, at least for these particular masses, sensible weak-scale masses, the off-diagonal entry for this thing has to be really small, something like, you know, 10 to the minus... 2 to, or well, few 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 3, depending on whether the insertions that you put in are due to off-diagonal entries in the left component, the left-handed fermions, or the right-handed fermions, or combinations of both, meaning left and right. Yeah, and the strongest ones for K0K0 bar mixing come from these left-right insertions, as well as a combination of left-left and right-right in the same body. That's the dominant piece to this. If you thought you could get away with this just at the first generation level, think again. You do Bina-Bina bar mixing, you still have restrictions on the off-diagonal entries. Okay, the same analysis goes through, but now you're dealing with off-diagonal entries between the first and the third entry, okay, on the squark mass matrix. And so now this is down by, well, this is the constraints from Bina-Bina bar mixing. Again, for say 500 GeV squarks and gluinos, give you a bound in the neighborhood of between 0.1 to 0.02, again, depending on combinations of left, right, right, or left, right insertions. And I'll tell you, I'll talk more about this type of thing in a second. These are just illustrating examples of a large number of problems, namely that just as there are issues with gate-up bar mixing, PNP-M bar mixing, there's the same thing with flavor violation in the lepton sector, say like mu to e gamma and tau to mu gamma, epsilon prime over epsilon, so processes that violate flavor by just one unit, epsilon k, the CP violating, or the imaginary part of delta m k, even beta s gamma has contributions from potential flavor violating pieces from say left right insertions. There are problems that can happen that show up even when you go to large tan beta, and there are related issues to these. They're not flavor violating per se, but they are related to this. Things like EDMs of all of our famous particles, like electron, neutron, and various atoms, and also this famous dimension 5 proton decay operator, which I'll mention a comment about it at the end. Okay, so. The statement that we all know is this, even though it's not said that loudly from rooftops, even though maybe it should be, that if you just naively supersymmetrize the standard model, meaning MSSM, flavor arbitrary, all right, it's completely ruled out for weak scale weak scale super partners. And certainly rule at least far beyond what the LEC can find. Okay? That's the statement. So there has to be some conspiracy, something going on in the flavor sector of supersymmetry that's going to conspire to be found at the LHC. Well, what we have been doing for a long time, and this goes back even more than 15 years, but many, many years of model building has been trying to get around the problem. And there's so many proposals, I'm just going to mention several of them, and some of the issues that come up with them: anomaly mediation, Gate-Jinot mediation. Several of them proposed by various people in this room. Okay, so there's a long list. They all have various drawbacks depending on which scenario you're thinking about. Drawbacks, or shall we say, at least model complications that you have to do to make the scenario go. For example, sequestering, in some combination of anomaly mediation, Gate-Jinot mediation, have to do this. There's always the persistent mu problem, or the mu getting mu and b mu of the same order in these ideas, similar with gauge mediation. And then with gauge mediation itself, it has its own long story, but we all know that, so it's not worth going through that. But all of these attempts, right, have tried to do one thing, right? They try to do the following, which I'm going to schematically draw as one big fat mass matrix, right? So the idea is that everyone before has tried to say, let's take the Squark mass matrix in all of its glory, its 6x6 components, all the mixing between left and right hand nines, and to try to get it into this form. And even the form that I've written here is still not quite what I mean. What I mean is something where this is 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, or something like that, okay, proportional to the size of the mass squares on these elements, so that it's diagonal in flavor space. And the only mixings that you are allowed are sort of left-right mixings that could go between different particular fermions in the basis in which the standard model fermions are the mass eigenstates with respect to the standard model. Right, so that's what we've shot for all of this time. And what I'm going to talk about now is what I think is very cool, is a completely different way of doing it. And it has immediate consequences that you would see at the LHC, and that makes it one of these exciting things. Is even right up to the last minute you can do this. Hi, John. Okay, so that's the background. Now let me get into the model. So, thanks, John. So, the second thing in my title is R symmetry, and so I want to talk about R symmetry and its role in supersymmetry. So R symmetry is what? It is something that is already in supersymmetry. This you know from John's book, I hope, which is that you, as you take fields and you promote them to superspace, you have these additional coordinates, the superspace coordinates, theta and theta bar, which have their own, they are complex parameters, which have their own rotational invariants, which you can do with this phase invariants, e to the I alpha. This e to the I alpha for a single coordinate is the U1R. The U1 is what is called the R symmetry of supersymmetry. It has the effect that when you take a particular superfield, here's just some random superfield expanded in terms of its components, and then you have it transform with charge R under U1R, the scalar transforms just like the superfield as I've written here, but then the fermion and the F component transform as one unit less. So that the scalar and the fermion transform differently. It's, as I said, it smells like R parity, but it's not really R parity. In the MSSM, this is sort of a lame transparency for the MSSM, but anyway, in the MSSM, what you have is superpotential, scalar potential, a whole bunch of terms. I've written some of them previously, and I'll write more later. The superpotential has R charge 2 because, of course, we've got theta coordinates out in front, so it has to get soaked up. Yeah. The Kähler is invariant. This tells you certain things. The superfield strength and the Gate-Jinot have R charge 1, again, something all the experts know. here, and then typically the assignment is that QUDLE, the super fields associated with the left and right-handed fermions of the standard model, have R charge 1 and the Higgs is at 0 to make Yukawa couplings invariant with respect to R. When you break supersymmetry, sometimes you break R symmetry, and it depends on what the breaking mechanism is. Let me point out one example, though, where it doesn't break the R symmetry, and that is just the old idea of an O'Rafferty model, right? So you just have an additional field in your theory, I've called it X here, that gets an expectation value for its F component, but not its scalar component. And with this particular assignment, namely the superpotential having R charge 2, X has to have R charge 2. You then compute the R charge at the F component, it's 0, so you could give it an expectation value and it doesn't break the R symmetry. And this is well known from the times of thinking about Susie breaking. It was sort of thought of as an accident or even maybe a problem, depending on your point of view. This type of thing, and I'm just sort of motivating this because I'm trying to get you to think, you know, where didn't R symmetry die 10 years ago? And in some level, it's come back, I think, a little bit. There has been related work that was unrelated to sort of our motivation when we went into this, but I think it's sort of amusing to point out, is that just as the O'Rafferty model preserves an R symmetry, there are models that seem to dynamically give you an O'Rafferty model, things like ISS. So Interligator, Seiberg, and Chi have proposed various supersymmetric models, which at low energy, their degrees of freedom in the composite description, in the low energy description, look just like an O'Rafferty model and preserves an R symmetry, or at least preserves maybe an approximate R symmetry. And the degree to which it's approximate depends on the details of the model. In some cases, it could be an approximate continuous symmetry. In some cases, it could be broken to a discrete subgroup, like a Z4 or Z2N. This is what Dine and Feng and company did, Silverstein, about a year and a half ago. The idea being, though, at least that it's people are actually starting to think about this, the idea that, you know, there may be an R symmetry that results at the end of one of these dynamical cascades. This is usually considered a problem, and that's the way, if you read the papers, they go and they say, oh, we've got an R symmetry, oh, sorry about that, but now let's go on. And the problem of R symmetry is very simple. So just as you can write Yukawa couplings, one of the things that you can't write is a Gijun mass. Okay? So this is automatic, namely that the Gijinos are buried within the gauge superfields here, W's. They have the same R charge as the superfield, necessarily. So to give them a mass, a Majorana mass, then I have to write an operator like that, and I've written M Planck, but it could be M of just some scale. Okay, don't take my Planck too seriously. So an operator such as this, where the X gets an F component, and then this will lead to a Majorana mass. But clearly, for this to go through, for this operator to write this thing down, we know that the WW has to have R charge 2, so X has R charge 0, so when we give X and X an F component, it breaks the R symmetry. So it violates the R symmetry to be able to write the Majorana mass. So Gijino masses don't exist if you have an R symmetry. Majorana Gijino masses don't exist if you have an R symmetry. Okay. That was the point, and that's the problem that most people phrase when it comes to at least global supersymmetry. Okay. These guys, Patty Fox, Ann Nelson, Neil Weiner, proposed or emphasized in 2002, and this idea goes back many years. There's a number of papers before this, and it goes, in fact, as I learned, all the way back to a Polchinski-Suskind paper from 81, this idea that you could have Dirac masses for the Gijinos if you have a D term for a U1. So a U1 in the hidden sector gets a D term through some mechanism. It could be, from our point of view, we're thinking it's just a spurion, okay, just something that has a D component. You do that. Here's our famous U1 prime from the hidden sector getting its D term. If you have, in addition to the D-term, but also a chiral superfield in the adjoint representation of whatever gauge group you're dealing with here, so adjoint of SU3 or SU2, so a color octet or a weak triplet, or for D1, then a singlet, okay, come back to that, this turns into just a Dirac mass for the gauging nose. Okay, so this is well known from the, for those of you who are familiar with the Supersoft paper of these guys, you're familiar with this, what this mass is, okay, where it comes from.
So what is the R counting here?
What is the R counting? Good, yeah. So in this way of doing it, W alpha is, W alpha has R charge 1, okay, and so its D component goes like, so you have W prime alpha, which is theta alpha D. Okay, so this is 1, 1, 0. So it preserves the R symmetry. Good. Okay, D term, we got that. All right, so that's the background. This is, as I said, questions, don't hesitate, you know, just jump in. There we go. That's the background. What we did was actually much smaller. We just said, well, okay, we're gonna take this set of terms, this set of components that we've got, and when you go through a model which has an R symmetry, it turns out that the vast majority of all of the Susie breaking the Susie flavor problem, the problem that comes from the supersymmetry breaking parameters that are not diagonal in flavor space, come from interactions that violate the R symmetry. And that was the new thing to us. We didn't know that before. To our knowledge, no one else knew that before, but that's as we understood the history of this. So okay, that's my claim. So now you're thinking, well, wait a second, let's go back and look at this. The MSSM R symmetry, where's the violation? Okay, you can go through this. So the violation, you can see, as I said, so Majorana masses are an example of a violation of the R symmetry. A terms are also a violation, and that you can tell because, again, if I write an A term like, let's say, A, I, J, U, Q, the quark, the superfield corresponding to the quark doublets, Higgs, right-handed quarks here. This whole thing has R charge 2, so I'll just write this whole thing has R charge 2. To generate one of these terms in the soft, to generate an A term, then I have scalar components on all of these guys. But where did this really secretly come from? As Marcus taught us a long time ago, this came from just writing a spurion in the superpotential of something. Keller potential. I'm going to remember this now. The Keller potential. S dagger over M subscale, then Q H U bar integral D 4 theta. Right. And then this goes up. Once I get S an F component. Susie breaking Vev, then this soaks up the D4 theta or the D2 theta bar, giving me back something that will turn into ultimately this term. Am I writing this right? I think I'm writing this right.
No, it's D2 theta.
D2 theta?
D2 theta.
Very good, because these are the scalars. Yeah. Now, yeah, very good.
That's not S dagger.
It's not S dagger, yes. I was writing that. Yeah, what I get for trying to think too quickly. Top of my head. Good, yes. All these scalar components, the lowest components of the superfield, and then this guy is where we take the F component from. So then if this thing has R charge 2, okay, from the superfields, then this thing has to have R charge 0, so if I give an F component to that, it violates the R symmetry, just like for the original mass. That was the point. Okay, so A terms also violate the R symmetry, and similarly, HUHD, so this written with R charge 2, where these guys have R charge 1, then HU, the mu term, okay, written out in, well, if I want to write it in the superpotential, the mu HUHD, this then has R charge 0, so the mu term itself is also violated. Okay, so the source of R symmetry violation is then the A terms here, mu and the Gugino masses, which I mentioned before. All right, so that's the first line. What do they allow? What do they mean? So it means that, for example, with the Gugino, you can now have a mass insertion that will flip, for example, a left-handed to a right-handed fermion through something that, if I then integrate out this Gugino, it gives rise to an effective dimension 5 operator that connects up these scalars, the left and right, with the left and right fermions. This type of thing, when once you then insert this into diagrams, diagrams that involve flavor, whether they be, you know, mixed flavor or other ones, that's in a. This is a bulk of the reason why the contributions to supersymmetry are as constrained as they are, because this is only dimension 5, so it's only one power of Mgluino that comes in. Okay, at least,
yeah. You're going to talk about scalar masses. I mean, that's the one. The first flavor violation I would think of is just off-diagonal scalar masses, and those are certainly not forbidden by our symmetry.
They're not, exactly. So I'll tell you exactly what happens to those.
Okay.
Yeah, no, but I'm done. So one step at a time, right? The first step is what things are completely gone, right? And then I'll tell you what are the size of the contributions as we go. So I'm absolutely getting there. Okay. Other questions on this? Okay. These things are gone. What else is gone? So if the mu term doesn't exist and A terms don't exist, then left-right mixing also doesn't exist. Okay, so these components to the 6x6 matrix, which marry off the left and right-handed scalars, the scalars that came from left and right-handed fermions, yeah, this entire block is gone. And as I'll show, and I'll tell you exactly what the bounds are from this left-right and otherwise, that leads to a big suppression of all the flavor violating observables that we know about. Okay. Other issues? Oh, okay, good. So now, our symmetric Susie. Okay. The first paper that we know of that went through something like this was actually by Lawrence Hall and Lisa Randall back in about 1990. And they proposed a weak scale model with R symmetry. That was actually the title of their paper. But they had an interesting setup. So their setup was they had a Gluino Dirac mass. Okay, so they added a chiral adjoint to give it a large mass. They had no mu term. So no mu term meaning, yeah, this didn't violate the R symmetry from this. They didn't add fermions in the adjoint representation of, say, SU2. So their Wino mass and Zeno mass were at least at tree level equal to the W and the Z masses, right? So it was just there were no other components. So this came just from electroweak symmetry breaking. It was the original ones. The Fotino would naively be zero, right, at tree level. But once you add in loops of tops and stops with different masses for the stops, then this generated a one loop mass for this guy. And married off the Fotino with one of the neutral components of the Higgsian. Okay. So that was the setup they had, and their main point was they found a significant suppression of electrodipole moments, which was something that was a big thing in that day. Okay, before a lot of the other flavor was still a problem then, but before other things were a problem, they discovered this. Okay. But of course, as written, this model, the way they did it, even though they made a sentence here or there about, oh, well, there could be a weak triplet, but we're not going to consider this, you know, it's ruled out by that too, because obviously we don't see a Wino or a Zeno or these particles at from left two bounds. And there's, you know, you can go through the paper, and it's an interesting thing to see the degree to which the model is dead by now. So, our idea, which we had, was similar to theirs in the idea of making it R-symmetric, but now having, in addition, mass terms for the Higgsinos, marrying off with additional fields, and Dirac masses for the weak triplet and for the singlet, for hybrid charge. So I'm going to work in this limit as sort of in an approximation in which U and R is a continuous symmetry, but it could be a large discrete symmetry, Z4, something like that. That's good enough as well, as we'll see. And I can talk about some of the issues that involve whether continuous, discrete, which one is better or worse in whatever scenario. Okay, so Gaugino-Dirac masses. Dirac masses for Gauginos. This is just what I had written down before. Okay, so here's the famous operator that leads to a marrying of the Gaugino with the fermion from the chiral adjoint, and you would just do this for all of the different gauge groups of the MXM. So the color octet, the weak triplet, and some singlet, okay, a singlet which I'm calling quote unquote an adjoint, but really it's just a singlet. Now these have R charge zero, so that the term that I've written over there is R invariant. Okay.
What are the U1 prime quantum numbers? Are those the zeros at the end, or
those are that's the this is the U1 hypercharge quantum. So they're all neutral under hypercharge, and then the U1 prime is whatever it is. You think of it like just a hidden sector spurion. It's a detail. That's all we have in mind. Okay. Sometimes I'm going to write this quantity here, d over m Planck, where d is dimension 2, so d over m Planck giving me a dimension 1 piece, namely a Majorana or a Dirac mass, fermion mass for these guys. That's just mv. Okay, mu terms. So mu terms can also be written in an R-symmetric way by just adding additional fields that have the quantum numbers of the Higgs, and you just marry them off. Okay, and
I'm not understanding why the mu term. I mean, it's the combination of mu and you can always assign the R charges to allow a mu term, but then you don't get a B mu term.
That's right. So
what's the actual statement?
Good. So the statement here is that I'm allowing a B mu term.
It's the R charges by allowing a B mu term.
That's right. I'm in a basis where I've allowed a B mu term and I don't have a mu term. That's right. Sorry. Good. Okay. So in that basis, then I can write mu terms which would marry off these the Higgs with this field, a new field, which has the quantum numbers of Higgs but has different R charge. Okay, so it has R charge 2. And you need to do this because, okay, you've got Higgsinos, you've got the fermions from the Higgs, and they have to somehow get a mass. Okay, otherwise they would have been ruled out by Lab 2. And this is how we do it. This, by the way, is something where you can write these terms down if you're thinking from the point of view of the relative size of different scales. You can just do Giudice-Mazziero again just on these terms, and that will give you a scale which is comparable to the scale of quarks and leptons, okay, with using just a singlet that gets an F term. Good. With both of these things, the absence of A terms and mu terms, right? All the left-right terms are gone. Okay, so we don't. So that's something that happens for the scalars. So now let me go through a number of the detailed consequences of this in the flavor section.
In gauge mediation, those terms are small, right?
Yes.
So a lot of it'd be interesting to see how different it is from gauge mediation.
Gauge mediation, the off diagonal, all of the A terms are small, but you do have diagonal terms with mu,
right?
Yeah. So you can still get have a left right insertion which is proportional to mu.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's different in that way. Okay, so now let's go through some of the consequences. So the absence of left-right means, for example, the worst offender involving a left-right mixing is actually mu to e gamma. Okay, so this contribution here, this particular insertion as a mass squared, an off-diagonal mass squared divided by a diagonal mass squared has to be smaller than, I'm going to do this in a second, but it has to be smaller than 10 to the minus 6, okay? So really small, really suppressed. So that type of contribution is just gone. So all of the left-right concerns with respect to flavor, every place where you can have a left-right insertion of the scalars is gone. This is EDMs are gone, but again for the same reason that Hull and Randall found. Okay. in addition to just so that there's a class of contributions that are just killed completely, but then there are the other contributions which are allowed, and the question is how big are they for some spectrum. The difference now is, though, that with Dirac gay genomes, the spectrum can be qualitatively different from the MSSM. Okay, and what do I mean by that? So I mean that, again, my famous operator leading to a Dirac mass. The Dirac mass can induce a scalar mass at one loop, but the scalar mass is finite. This is something that Fox, Nelson, and Weiner found in 2002 and was in some ways the motivation for their model and the motivation for the title of their paper, namely what they called supersoft. So supersoft, and I don't want to go into their model in detail, but just to mention the operator that leads to scalar masses is this, I hope. This is an insertion of four powers of the D term, and then Q dagger Q on the end. And I need four powers because I need to soak up four theta and theta, well, two thetas and two theta bars to get this thing out. This is in the context of just having a D term. This would then lead to a scalar mass squared that goes like M Dirac. So it goes like D to the fourth over N to the sixth, which I can rewrite as MD, an actual mass term, like, for example, a gay genome mass to the fourth power, a Dirac gay genome mass to the fourth power divided by whatever the scale is that gave rise to this. Okay, so this thing being a higher dimensional thing tells me that there is no counterterm. And so the D term does induce a finite contribution to the scalar mass. This is distinct from the MSSM, where the Majorana mass induces a scalar mass squared, but it is log divergent, right? So that if you run from any scale down, the log always pulls the scalar mass squared up to of order the gay genome mass. This is well known, even in just gauge mediation with only a small hierarchy between where the messenger scale is and where the weak scale is. You don't need much running before you can pull the squarks up to of order the Dirac, up to of order the Majorana gay genome mass. That doesn't happen with Dirac masses. So you get the benefit that you can potentially separate the gay genome mass from the scalar masses by a loop factor, a four pi. Okay. Heavy Dirac and no dimension five. So this is I sort of stated it already, but the idea is then that in places where you have violations of flavor, if I can increase the gay genome mass a little bit, I get suppressions that go like the quark mass divided by the gay genome mass. Okay. That's what you get. Naively, you couldn't do this separation, again, in the MSSM, because they would be drawn up. So that's why people never really thought about this limit in detail in the past. But now you can do it, and you can do it by, as I say, up to about a factor of 4 pi, depending on your couplings. 4 pi-ish. It's important because in the case of separating it for just Majorana masses, you get some number of powers of the squark mass divided by the gay genome mass from just Majorana masses. But when you do Dirac, then inevitably, because the chiral adjoint doesn't couple to the fermions of the usual MSSM, you have to put in, think of it like two insertions. It's a Dirac mass. So now it gets suppressed by an additional power of 1/1 the genome mass. So it goes, so every place before that you had a diagram that went like the squark mass divided by the gluino mass to some power, it now goes to that power squared. How does that help? All right, let me show you. So now you do, say, you go back to the thing I started with from the beginning, right? I started with K0 bar mixing, and I said, this is a disaster. And here's, and how bad the disaster is the numbers that I've shown you for these masses of squark and gluino. If I, again, just to sort of take a slightly different limit on it, take a slightly different take on this, if you go to the limit of large squark masses, not the limit I'm going to take, but you go to the limit of large squark masses, just to get an idea of how bad this gets, it goes like this, namely, g to the fourth, the usual power, the insertion of whatever it is, divided by the squark mass squared. But notice that it goes like the insertion delta squared divided by squark mass squared, so that if the insertion has to be smaller than 10 to the minus 3, then it tells me that this squark mass has got to be larger than 10 to the 3 times the weak scale. hence numbers that are, you know, very large, you know, hundreds of TeV generically if you had completely arbitrary off-diagonal elements. Okay? Now, for us, what happens? Yeah. Okay, all this time to get to these results. Here we are. So, first, there's no left-right insertion, so that constraint doesn't exist at all. But there is the possibility of putting in two left-left insertions, or a left-left and a right-right insertion, which correspond to what? It corresponds to, again, taking that 6x6 matrix and taking these off-diagonal elements just in the mass squared parts. This is the part that Marcus was just referring to. If you do this for just left-left, what we find is that you can have arbitrary sized off-diagonal elements here, so long as the Gluino is, well, the numbers, if you can't read this, are 2, 4, and 6 TeV as you go up on the plot, and the squark mass on the bottom is 200 GeV on the far end to 1,000 over here. So for example, you take 500 GeV for the squark, you go up and you see that a Gluino mass of 4 TeV allows arbitrary off-diagonal size for the left-hand components of the squark mass. Okay. You know, it could be arbitrary. All right. At least, you know, in the limit that in the limit by which we did the calculation, which is of course the mass insertion. If you have left-left and right-right insertions, this is actually more constrained. This is the one where the constraint again from this 10 to the minus 3 came from the previous slide. Now, for us, what we find, again, you go to a 500 GeV squark mass, and you read off for, say, off-diagonal entries being completely arbitrary, equal in size to the diagonal elements, and you see that it's more like 7 TeV for the Gluino. Now, 7 and 500 is a separation which may or may not be, you know, that's a moderate separation, but, you know, you can lower this to, say, something like 0.3, which is still order 1 to a lot of people, and this is, you know, 4 TeV. So the point being that you can have, you know, multi-TeV Gluino mass, hundreds of GeV squark mass, nearly completely arbitrary in their mass matrix structure, and this is allowed as long as you have the structure that we put in. That's the state. This is Kano bar. You can now do this for all of the different flavor processes. Now let me just mention a few of them as I go, and then I'll make a few sort of summary. And then, you know, take questions.
Can you imagine that the squarks receive additional flavor violating masses in addition to soft, super soft?
Exactly, yeah, exactly. So what we were imagining specifically is two spurions, a D term and an F term, both of which have both of which preserve the R symmetry. So for example, I can write if I have like an Rafferty model with S equal to theta squared F, then as long as this guy has R charge 2, this is fine. And then I can go and write terms like this. This one I'll try to write correctly this time. There we go. And the emphasis being on the I and J, right, being potentially being arbitrary. So I can just write these type of terms into the theory. No problem. Right, so
for this country, we need to tune them in any way to make the...
So the statement is I don't need to tune with respect to flavor indices in any way, as long as I mean
the overall scale.
Overall scale, good. So what I do need to do is to take as you can see, I need to take the Dirac mass larger than the scalar mass by 4pi-ish, depending on what degree of off-diagonal you're willing to allow me will tell me how big I need to make this. But it's maybe a factor of 5, okay, difference in the mass. Yeah. So indeed, that's right. So the D term, where is it? The D term here has to be modestly larger than the F term that comes from here by, you know, factor of 5 in the mass.
So I guess what I should compare this to is the normal Susi case where both masses would have to be up in the bulky TeV.
In the normal Susi case, if you had arbitrary off-diagonal mixings, it would have to be in the hundreds to thousand TeV range.
Okay.
For the scalars to suppress the contributions of flavor. So that's the comparison. So it's off-scale with respect to
So you know, Sincha and Graham, you might be amused to know that you know, I spent with some collaborators who spent a long time working on gauge-mediated analogs of D-type supersymmetry breaking, and it turns out that the scalar masses only arise at three loops in the simplest models you can make for complicated reasons, and it's hard to avoid this. So in fact, the reason there's no paper, we couldn't avoid this.
Right.
So that would be sort of, you know, it's not what you want because it doesn't have, it also doesn't have the flavor violation, but
right.
There may be some weird reason.
Right.
So anyway, it's just amusing
right.
that it does actually give you exactly this kind of a spectrum, just without the without the flavor violation.
Yeah. So we absolutely have to talk about these issues because the size of the D term and the F terms is an interesting issue. There is this small higher
for the same M, right? For the same M,
yeah, for the same M. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And therein lies, you know, one of the interesting things, right? Because depending on what you put in for messengers to communicate this, well, then okay, you could imagine separating how.
I mean, one point that's it's a very simple point, but it's somehow, you know, there's this lore that D terms are always smaller than F terms.
Yes.
And I think that's probably true. It's hard to make a counterexample, at least if you couple the supergravity. But it's very easy to make models where the F terms just aren't allowed to couple to, like, for example, gauge-mediated type models, where the F terms are just simply not allowed to couple to messengers just because of other symmetries. That's trivial to do. So if you can do that, you can also break those symmetries a little bit. And, you know, so I'm sure that there are some sensible model-building ways of getting smaller, effectively smaller F terms than D terms. I don't think that will be very hard to
do. Yeah. Good. All right. Let me tell you a couple of more things. I don't have that many more to go.
So,
okay.
Can you go back a little bit? I mean,
yes.
I didn't really understand. Can you just say again exactly this thing about the dimension 5 fermion scalar?
Yes.
Effective operators being
yes.
suppressed. Can you explain that? I didn't get that.
So the statement is that you usually have contributions. So, for example, if I'm just thinking about trying to think of whether I should put this
actually,
in.
Maybe you should talk about this later. Maybe you should get to the rest of your thing. Because I'm sure,
for
example, John Conway here will want to hear about what this means for the LHC.
Okay. I'm happy to talk about this
this
in a bit. But let me go through this. Yeah, stepwise. So okay. So KNR vexing. This is epsilon prime over epsilon is another case. This is the delta F equal to 1 flavor violating observable. And it, again, if you go in and you just put in the bounds that you obtain from experiment, you find that the imaginary part of this off diagonal entry, delta 1, 2 in the down type, has to be less than 10 to the minus 5 if you had left right insertion. So it's really, really small, 10 to the minus 5 in the magnitude of the imaginary part of this component. There's no left right here, so there's no bound. Okay, there's really no bound at all for this. It's a small caveat here for experts, but I won't go into
that. Why is that? Why is it so enormously different from the left?
You'll see a little bit of that when I do mu to e gamma. Although I don't have the diagram in front of me here, as I can tell. Mu to e gamma is similar sort of craziness between left right and left left. We can go through it. I'll show you what the issue is, but the left right has to be really small, 10 to the minus 6. Left left is still has to be modestly small, but you can see it's, you know, in the neighborhood of 10 to the minus 2, 7.7, 10 to the minus 3. Again, in an R symmetric model or without any left right mixing, then this is completely gone. So all the bound that you have to satisfy is this one, and there again, you don't need to raise the Dirac gauge mass very high before eventually you just suppress this completely. And you can see, even from this plot, you know, a few hundred GeV sleptons, TeV we know or so. Actually, I should say, well, this is several hundred GeV Beano, and then our Weino we took for this calculation to be double in mass than that. So maybe 1.5 TeV, and that's enough where you can have arbitrary off-diagonal extents. There are comments I could make about 10 beta, but I'll skip those just so I can tell John.
No, don't.
About, there are comments I could make about 10 beta. So the statement about 10 beta is what? The statement is that generically you can get a coupling between the up-type Higgs to down-type fermions through loops, through interactions, which at the end of the day, they work into interactions involving involving mu term or a terms, and there's a number of different diagrams, and I'm only showing one of them, and a Majorana gauge mass. These type of diagrams are gone. Okay, they don't exist, so there is no flavor enhancement that you get at large 10 beta. Okay, that's the statement. So now phenomenology for John. Okay.
And
everyone else, absolutely, yes. But if I'm going to sketch a spectrum, this is the kind of thing to have in your mind. Okay, this is sort of the thing we have in our mind. Obviously, there's no numbers on here other than order of magnitude on the far left hand side, because that's the stage we're at in terms of phenomenology, is order of magnitude. But you get an idea of it anyway. What we saw was that a gluino of several TeV allowed basically arbitrary off diagonal elements. Similarly, the Wino could be larger than about a TeV or so. There is one issue with regarding the Wino, again, the experts may be interested in, which is you can give a Dirac Wino, and you also have this scalar in the SU2, in the triplet representation, and it can get an expectation value, and then it can lead to contribution to delta rho, and again, that's small enough as long as the Wino is heavier than about a TeV. So there's a self-consistency between both the bounds from something like mu d gamma as well as from electroweak. Okay, so that's not a problem. But that's the reason the Wino can't be arbitrarily light. How light the Beano can be is not actually completely clear to us. We didn't calculate contributions of the Beano to say, can a bar mixing? It's obviously going to be down by g prime to the fourth compared to g weak, and it's down by hypercharge factors. So it's going to be small, but naively, when you look at this, sort of just doing power counting of this, it could be important if you take the Beano particularly light. So how light it can be, probably hundreds of GeV. Maybe it has to be the upper hundreds of GeV. We don't have a precise answer for that, but at least it gives you an idea. It may be able to be quite light. Higgsinos, Swarks, Sleptons. As you go through, holding the Gaugino masses fixed, you tend to make the flavor better as you lower the Swarks and Slepton masses, which is sort of the converse to what you'd ordinarily expect, because again, you're pushing this higher heat apart. And then there is the scalar components to the fermions that married off with the Gaugino fermion. So you have Gauginos, meaning these two-component fermions from the gauge superfields, right? There are fermions that marry off and give them a Dirac mass, and then there's scalars that are the partners to those adjoints. The color octet scalar and a weak triplet scalar, and they have some mass, and again, it's sort of an open field how big they are. There's some reason to think that at least the weak triplet probably has to be modestly heavy.
But do they carry strong charge?
One of them. So there's a color octet that does.
Yeah.
Right. So it looks like I don't know what to say. I mean, I don't know what it looks like. Okay. But it has the quantum numbers of a scalar in the color octet representation. So it's like a gluon, right? But it's massive.
So it's the excess multijet production.
For example. We haven't studied this, but yeah.
One of the interesting things about that those things, the we call them the S-Gauginos because they're the partner of the partner of the Gaugino, so they're scalars, right? But anyway, the S-Gauginos are R-parity even, so you can singly produce them, but through a fusion-type mechanism. Okay, there's no direct coupling of these things other than the ordinary strong interactions, which could just pair-produce them, right? But then there's
isn't that good enough?
Yeah, it is. But I'm saying, in addition, it's also interesting that they can be singly produced, and so you can imagine. So, that in other words, you can imagine
they can be split off by strong interaction.
Yeah, and they act. But on the other hand, their dominant decay modes are actually to pairs of squarks, and so they will cascade decay. But these cascade decays, if you could reconstruct them, would reconstruct to a single resonance mass. So there's, you know, a lot of work being done on how well you can reconstruct these cascade decays, so you might actually be able to do this.
This is very cool. This is excellent.
So, but these masses are respect all the symmetries, so they can be arbitrarily heavy.
Yeah. So I mean, in particular, the same terms that I wrote down here now erased, but you can barely see. You know, S dagger S, Q dagger Q. I can also write adjoint dagger adjoint, right? So that will give them whatever mass.
I mean, there's also a constraint. Actually, these adjoint masses contribute logarithmically enhanced contribution to the scalar masses, which are actually negative. So they can't be too big, otherwise they're going to make the squark and slepton masses negative.
Yeah, but it's like another new problem because nothing protects. Keeps them light.
So you only need to worry if you want to go up above 100 TeV or something. If you're willing to stop thinking at 100 TeV, you don't need to worry about this.
Why do you think it's a mu problem?
It's a running up to the gut scale sort of problem. I mean, if you don't care about running up to high scales, then you don't care about this problem.
There's masses for the scale. There's soft masses for the scalars, right? That you can write. But it's just the same soft mass that you would write for anyone else.
Why can't I just write it?
The adjoint has R charge. Is R charge neutral? Is R charge zero? Which it has to be so that you can write the Dirac mass. So that's why the term is like this. Good. Rough spectrum. I've already said these things. Squarks, arbitrary, Dirac Luino, and the Luino heavy. These are other scalar, other interesting particles to go in. To look for, and it would be great to really seriously go through this, and this is something that some of us are starting to do, is to see how well various sets of these features can be found. Okay, so but that's very preliminary. Yeah. Let me just give you an idea, though. So the one qualitative difference between this and every other SUSY model is arbitrary off-diagonal entries in the squark and slepton mass squared matrices. So what does that mean? It means flavor violation in squark and slepton production, for example. So you can produce a pair of squarks. They have arbitrary flavor. There's no sense of saying that you produce stops or you produce spottums or something. They're just squarks, whatever they are. And then they occasionally, some of those squarks will decay to, say, a time, or the other one on it will go to some other quark. And this happens frequently, right?
So they're not mass eigenstates?
The mass eigenstates are arbitrary in flavor, the way to think about it.
Flavor-wise.
They're not lined up with the quark mass eigenstates.
Exactly.
Okay.
They're not
unmixed.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So it leads to, for example, we don't even know exactly what is the best way to do this, but let me give you at least a couple of ideas of the kind of things to look for. It would be things like single top production through this squark pair production. And then you get large missing energy from whatever this famous LSP is supposed to be. Okay. This is the kind of thing you can do. And this doesn't involve, you know, unlike single top where you have to do something special, right? You pop a B quark or something from the proton. So that makes this interesting. What did I just do? I pressed the button. Okay, hopefully that didn't do it. It changed my screen, but it didn't change this. One idea. A second idea is, say, something like... One second. Oh, there we go. Okay. A second idea is slepton production. So it's just the same process, but now producing sleptons. They can mix, and they'll go into, say, something like, you know, muon electron. All right, I know, yeah, there's backgrounds. So it's you have to dig this signal out from a background of, say, taus or of, say, W production. Okay, so this requires a detailed analysis to look at. Some people have looked at...
In cascades, you could probably do this better, right? You make squarks if they decay through cascades. The flavor, lepton flavor violation will be a lot easier to see.
You jump me by 2 seconds, Marcus. That's this sentence. Okay. Another is a heavier neutralino to a lighter neutralino and a pair of leptons. Yeah, such as through a cascade.
Or if the subtons are very heavy, we can do it. We can separate them from WW very easily.
Let's talk about that afterward. Good. The problem with this one is, though, if this is a Wino-like object, the Wino has to be heavy. So I don't know how frequently you're producing these things and seeing this decay. This is the way a number of people have studied it, to be sure. And it's not clear to me that this is actually going to work here because of just the nature of the spectrum. But
no, I think I don't know if this is. Yeah, I mean, chi-2s. I mean, let's see. I'm just thinking about just ordinary cascade decays. It's quite typical that if squarks are heavier than sleptons, if squarks decay through a Wino, for example,
right.
Wino's decay through.
Right.
I mean, it depends on your spectrum, but
exactly.
It can very well happen
right.
that you essentially have strong production of sleptons through cascades initiated by strong.
You can. So you have to do the competition between that and just say a direct decay to. If the Beano were the lightest, then a direct decay to the Beano, and a quark, right? So and I don't know, off the top of my head right now, I don't know which one is going to dominate. I mean, it's absolutely an interesting question to understand what's the simplest way to go at it. But I'm just sort of trying to point out that this is a large effect. The sleptons flavor violation is large. Oh, and also in particular, there's no same sign lepton signal here. Right, because that always requires a Majorana mask. It's gone, okay, so that doesn't exist.
I saw you expected the Beano to be heavy, so the ISP is Fixino or Gramtino?
Open questions. Thank you, Shinja. What is the lightest SUSY particle? Number one. All right. What can it be? That's a good question. Maybe a Higgsino, but then there are potential issues with it being a Higgsino, right? There maybe a Beano if it can be light enough and it doesn't contribute the flavor in an excessive way, okay? Which requires more calculation. Maybe you want to even do the NMSSM because of the nature of the sort of interactions you want it. For example, in particular, if you want to get dark matter out, you may need to have to do something like that, and so then maybe some component of singly. Which one can be found? We've already been having this discussion for about 5-10 minutes now, and it's and this is absolutely an interesting question to go through. I don't really think the Higgs mass is a big issue, but it is true that if the weak triplet is light, then there is no D term, right? There is no tree level D term for the Higgs potential, so the Higgs is generically way too light. So it would seem as though that should be of order the mass. The weak triplet scalar should be of order the mass of the Dirac mass to the gauge book to the.
And there's just a direct bound from the T parameter. I mean, that thing has to be above the T for sure.
The Wino does exactly, and so then that and so if you want to regenerate the D term, then you've got to take the scalar to be of order that same mass. That was not an option in Supersoft because they were always generating masses, while loops pressed. Here we've got, F terms, D terms, so, okay. As long as you're willing to play with that hierarchy between the sort of 500 GeV to 2.5 TeV scale and you adjust, then you're fine with it. Unification generically doesn't work, right? You've added color octets, you've added weak triplet scalars, you have Higgses. Amusingly, when you just take the setup that I have, the SU2 and the SU3 coupling beta functions shift by the same amount, so two lines still meet at a point. The only non-trivial thing is they meet at the same point that, well, roughly speaking, they meet at the same point that you started with the usual gut scale. It's the hypercharge that doesn't meet. Okay, so you can play games to try to get this to go. They're not easy games to play. Maybe something like trinification is a way to go. We have some statements in the paper. I don't want to get into this. This is really a UV thing, which is amusing if you're into a UV. D terms, F terms, Shinjo, we talked about that. This issue of exactly whether the symmetry is continuous, approximate, etc. And there are supergravity issues, which I haven't talked about. But I didn't want to talk about them because Marcus is in the room. So great. Let me summarize. All right, let me summarize. So. The FCNC is the strongest constraint on supersymmetry, despite what N-Subra people are usually say, okay? The lore is that Susie breaking masses have to be flavor blind. Okay, this is what we've got into thinking. This is the existence proof that this is not right. It is possible to have a model where you could have arbitrary flavor violation in the Skork and slept on mass matrices, and yet the flavor is under control. Okay, so it's something that I think you can see at the LHC if you go through this if we go through this carefully. Another statement is that much of this supersymmetry-induced flavor violation is a result of the R symmetry violation, which is an interesting statement that I didn't know before this. And I've already talked about the phenomenology. So that's it. Okay. Thank you. Sorry for going over.
This is the first time I've heard this, and this last statement really could have a profound set of consequences if, depending on how seriously it's taken in the experimental community.
I don't disagree.
Thousands of hours could be, diverted to following. So should we?
The statement is, it's possible. And we didn't know it was possible before.
Yeah,
so
it's new.
But you can think of it from the point of view of what should you be looking for that you didn't already
right.
look for
exactly.
before. And I can tell you, what I know thus far is the places where this model impacts specific pieces of phenomenology. I can't tell you for sure that these specific pieces were not going to already be picked up in another search. Like single top is something you're already going to look for. Single top plus missing energy, I don't know. Okay, so, but you have missing energy searches as well, but they're missing energy plus, plus leptons, plus jets, but if you have something that reconstructs to a top, I don't know where that's going to fall.
You hear these statements at searches talks.
Yeah.
Well, in Susie, you can't have blah, 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 and in Susie, this happens.
Well,
all this is gone.
Oh, yeah.
This is
true.
And so
sure.
then,
yeah.
on the one hand, it gives us a lot more to look for. On the other hand,
I always have these fears with regard to searches. Yeah.
Nevertheless,
yeah.
this is fun.
Yeah.
I think just my reaction to this, so this is the first time I've seen this, I think this is great stuff, and I think that it's, if nothing else, it's an object lesson. We talk about, we keep telling you guys, I don't think it's going to be minimal supra. It's going to be something different. And this is you can think of this would be one scenario that might be, whether you call it nightmare or dream, I don't know, but it's
right.
It's where probably there isn't going to be a lot of work done, even despite this paper on this beforehand. So even if this is right, we're going to be flying by the seat of our pants and trying to.
It's like the
catch
curse.
Up.
May you live in interesting times.
I think that's.
Yeah.
I think this is a great example of what, how that sort of a situation we might very well be in.
I mean, for the model builders in the room, there are more issues to talk about. Are they worse or are they better or worse than other problems that come along with other models? I think that's open to debate. Okay, but it's no model is ever completely free of things. That's just life. Okay, and what this is, So, and I already talked about some of the issues, the hierarchy, D-term, F-term, and such things, but, the idea that you can have arbitrary flavor violation is something that, I never would have guessed that until going through this.
And BDS-gamma?
BDS-gamma is completely fine. There, the only constraint was on the left-right mixing, the diagram with a left-right insertion. That had a restriction of about 10 to the minus 2 on the delta in the insertion you put in, and again, there's no left-right, so completely fine.
Proton decay.
I didn't mention this, but the famous operator. If you have continuous U1R invariants, then QQQL, which you can account for yourself, has R charge 4, right? Is not allowed. So this operator divided by M Planck, right, would ordinarily lead to proton decay far in excess of what the bounds are, because this coefficient has to be smaller than something like 10 to the minus 6 or some tiny number like that. And so now this, this side of things.
Well, in particular, your U1R contains R parity, right?
Precisely.
So it's going to, anything that's forbidden by R parity will also be forbidden here.
But our parity didn't for this, right?
No, that's our parity violation.
No.
Sorry.
Parrot.
Our parity, Z2, there's four fields.
Okay.
No, it's allowed.
Okay.
This thing ordinarily in the MSSM tells you you shouldn't see proton decay. Now, what people usually say about this type of operators, they say, oh, well, but, you know, we don't know the source of flavor. We don't know how that works. And probably the same thing that leads to flavor couplings between Q, H, and down-type quarks, the same things that lead to that to be small, well, that probably makes this coefficient small. That's the hope. Okay, and in practice, if you do a gut, right, you do a gut, you generate this operator suppressed by M gut, which looks like it's terrible, but it's suppressed because you've got a triplet exchange, and the triplet is coupling with Yukawa strength. So you have powers of two Yukawas in front of you, and that's what makes it.
By the way, this brings up another piece of paranoia. I mean, I've certainly spent some time, lots of time solving the Suzy flavor problems, but I'll be honest with you, I've always had in the back of my mind the question of whether there really is a Suzy flavor problem, because you can say it this way, you know, construct for me a model where there is a Suzy flavor problem, okay, which has never been done. And what I mean by that is something has got to explain why the Yukawa couplings are small, say for the electrons and so on. Show me a model where that doesn't feed, where that is explained, but yet you get arbitrary flavor violation in other places. You know, it's actually not completely obvious that to me that the generic situation is that you get large flavor violation. That it isn't more likely that it's actually just suppressed by no more than the corresponding Yukawa couplings. But anyway.
There's the two comments to that is, sure, it's possible, but it is also true, though, that right once you have the source of physics that generates flavor, if it is higher than the source that than the operators that communicate super am I getting this the other way around? The flavor is lower than the source of where supersymmetry breaking comes in, then it doesn't look good, because it initially looks like it's flavor blind, but then you do your thing to get the Yukawas right, and then that will then again muck up the apparent diagonality that you started with in the Suzy breaking scheme. So it depends on where flavor comes from, what scale is flavor coming in comparison to the Suzy breaking.
Thank Graham again.
Thank you.